Now confronted once more with that ubiquitous female, Jonathan capitulated with poor grace. "Well, can I come with you when my baby sister is here to look after Mama?"
"I'll tell you what, old fella, I'll do better than that. How would you like to go on a big boat across the sea?" Now, this was the kind of talk that Jonathan preferred, and his face lit up.
"Can I sail it?" he demanded.
"I'm sure the captain will let you help him," Ralph chuckled. "And when we get to London, we will stay in a big hotel, and we will buy all sorts of presents for your Mama."
Kathy dropped her knitting into her lap and stared at him in the lamplight. "What about me?" Jonathan demanded. "Can we buy all sorts of presents for me too?"
"And for your baby sister," Ralph agreed. "Then, when we come back, we will go to Johannesburg and we'll buy a big house with shining chandeliers and marble floors."
"And stables for my pony," Jonathan clapped his hands.
"And a kennel for Sharka," Ralph ruffled his curls. "And you will go to a fine brick school with lots of other little boys."
Jonathan's grin wavered slightly. That was perhaps carrying things a little too far. But Ralph stood him on his feet again, slapped his backside lightly, and told him,
"Now go and kiss your mother good night, and ask her to tuck you up in your cot."
Kathy hurried back from the nursery tent, moving with the appealing awkwardness of her pregnancy into the firelight, and she came to where Ralph sat in the canvas folding chair, with his boots stretched to the blaze, and the whiskey glass in his hand. She stopped behind his chair, put both arms around his neck, and with her lips pressed to his cheek whispered, "Is it true, or are you just teasing me? You've been a good, brave girl for long enough. I'm going to buy you a home you didn't even dare dream about. With chandeliers.
And a carriage to take you to the opera."
"I don't know if I like opera. I've never been to one."
"We'll find out in London, won't we?"
"Oh, Ralph, I'm so happy I think I could cry. But why now?
What's happened to make it all change?" "Something is going to happen before Christmas that is going to change our lives. We are going to be rich."
"I thought we were already rich."
"I mean really rich. The way Robinson and Rhodes are rich."
"Can you tell me what it is?"
"No," he said simply. "But you only have a few short weeks to wait, just until Christmas."
"Oh, darling," she sighed. "Will you be away that long? I miss you so."
"Then let's not waste any more time talking."
He stood up, picked her up in his arms and carried her carefully to the bale tent under the spreading wild fig tree. In the morning, Kathy stood with Jonathan beside her, holding his hand to restrain him. And they looked up at Ralph on the footplate of the big green locomotive. "We always seem to be saying goodbye." She had to raise her voice above the hiss of steam from the driving wheels and the roar of the flames in the firebox.
"It's the last time," Ralph promised her.
How handsome and gay he was, it made her heart swell until it threatened to choke her. "Come back to me as soon as you can."
"I will, just as soon as I can."
The engine driver pulled down the brass throttle handle, and the huff of steam drowned Ralph's next words. "What? What did you say?" Kathy trotted heavily beside the locomotive as it began to trundle down the steel tracks.
"Don't lose the letter," he repeated.
"I won't," she promised. And then the effort of keeping level with the rolling locomotive became too much. She came up short and waved with the white lace handkerchief until the curve in the southbound tracks carried the train out of sight beyond the heel of a kopje, and the last mournful sob of its steam whistle died on the air. Then she turned back to where Isasi waited with the trap. Jonathan wrested his hand from hers and raced ahead to scramble up onto the seat. "Can I drive them, Isasi?" he pleaded. And Kathy felt a prick of anger at the fickleness of boyhood. One moment tearful and bereft, the next shrieking with the prospect of handling the reins. As she settled onto the buttoned leather rear seat of the trap, she slipped her hand into the pocket of her apron to check that the sealed envelope that Ralph had left with her was still safe. She drew it out and read the tantalizing instruction he had written upon the face. "Open only when you receive my telegraph." She was about to return it to her pocket. Then she bit her lip, fighting the temptation, and at last ran her fingernail under the flap, splitting it open, and drew out the folded sheet. "Upon receiving my telegraph, you must send the following telegram immediately and urgently to Major Zuga Ballantyne, headquarters of Rhodesian Horse Regiment at Pitsani, Bechuanaland. Your wife, Mrs. Louise Ballantyne, gravely ill, return immediately, King's Lynn." Kathy read the instruction twice, and suddenly she was deadly afraid. "Oh, my mad darling, what are you going to do?" she whispered, and Jonathan urged the horses into a trot back along the track towards the camp. The workshops of the Simmer and Jack gold mine stood below the steel headgear on the crest of the ridge. The town of Johannesburg sprawled away in the low valley and over the further rounded hills. The workshop was roofed and walled with corrugated iron, and the concrete floor was stained with black puddles of spilled engine oil. It was oven hot under the iron, and beyond the big double sliding doors at the end of the shed, the sunlight of early summer was blinding. "Close the doors," Ralph Ballantyne ordered, and two of the small group went to struggle with the heavy wood and iron structures, grunting and sweating with unaccustomed physical effort. With the doors closed, it was gloomy as a Gothic cathedral, and the white beams of sunlight through chinks in the iron walls were filled with swirling dust motes. Down the centre of the floor stood a row of 50 yellow drums. Stenciled on each lid in black paint were the words, "Heavy Duty Engine Oil, 44 gallons." Ralph slipped off his beige linen jacket, pulled down the knot of his necktie, and rolled up his shirt sleeves. He selected a 2-pound hammer and a cold chisel from the nearest workbench and started to hack open the lid of the nearest drum. The four other men crowded closer to watch. The hammer strokes echoed hollowly about the long shed. The yellow paint flew off in tiny flakes beneath the chisel, and the raw metal was bright as newly minted shillings. At last, Ralph prized open the half-severed lid and bent it back. The surface of the oil glimmered glutinous and coal-black in the poor light. Ralph thrust his right arm into it as far as the elbow and drew out a long oilskin-wrapped bundle dripping with the thick oil. He carried it to the workbench and slipped the binding with the chisel, and there were exclamations of satisfaction as he stripped away the covering. "The very latest Lee Metfield bolt-action rifles firing the new smokeless cordite load. There's no other rifle in the world to match it." They passed the weapon from hand to hand, and when it reached Percy Fitzpatrick, he rattled the bolt, opening and closing it rapidly. "How many?"
10 to a drum," Ralph answered. 50 drums."
"And the rest of them?" demanded Frank Rhodes. He was as unlike his younger brother as Ralph was to Jordan. A tall, lean man with deep-set eyes and high cheekbones, his greying hair receding from a deep, bony forehead.
"I can bring through a shipment every week for the next 5 weeks," Ralph told him, wiping his greasy hands on a ball of cotton waste.
"Can you do it quicker than that?"
"Can you clean and distribute them quicker than that?" Ralph countered, and without waiting for a reply, turned to John Hayes Hammond, the brilliant American mining engineer whom he trusted more than Mr. Rhodes's effete brother. "Have you decided on the final plan of action?" he asked. "Mr. Rhodes will want to know when I return to Kimberley." "We will seize Pretoria Fort and the arsenal as our first objective," Hayes Hammond told him. And they fell into a detailed discussion, with Ralph scribbling notes on the back of a cigarette packet. When at last Ralph nodded and stuffed the packet into his back pocket, Frank Rhodes demanded, "What is the news from Bulawayo?"
"Jamieson has his men, over 600 of them. They are mounted and armed. He'll be ready to move southwards to Pitsani on the last day of the month. That's his latest report."
Ralph shrugged on his jacket again. "It'll be wiser if we are not seen together."
He returned to shake hands with each of them. But when he reached Colonel Frank Rhodes, he could not resist the temptation to add,
"It would also be wiser, Colonel, if you could limit your telegraph messages to essentials only. The code you are using, the daily references to this
fictitious gold mine flirtation of yours is enough to attract the attention of even the most dim-witted of the Transvaal police agents, and we know for certain that there is one in the Johannesburg Telegraph office.
Sir, we have indulged in no unnecessary traffic, Frank Rhodes replied stiffly.
Then how do you rate your latest effort? Quote, are the 600 northern shareholders in a position to take up their debentures? Unquote.
Ralph mimicked his prim old maidish diction,
then nodded farewell and went out to where his horse was tethered and rode down the road to Fordsburg Dip and the city.
Elizabeth rose at a glance from her mother and began to gather up the soup bowls.
"We haven't finished, Bobby," she told her young brother. "I'm not hungry, Lizzie," the child protested. "It tastes funny."
"You always have an excuse not to eat, Master Robert," Elizabeth scolded him. "No wonder you are so skinny. You'll never grow up strong and tall like your papa."
"That's enough, Elizabeth,"
Robin spoke sharply.
"Leave the boy if he's not hungry. You know he isn't well."
Elizabeth glanced at her mother, then dutifully stacked Robert's bowl with the others. None of the girls had ever been allowed to leave food, not even when they were giddy with malaria. But she had learned not to protest the unfairness of Robin's indulgence of her only son. With the kerosene lantern in her other hand, Elizabeth went out of the back door and crossed to the thatched kitchen hut.
"It is time she had a husband,"
Juba shook her head mournfully.
"She needs a man in her bed, and a baby at her breast to make her smile."
"Oh, don't talk nonsense, Juba," snapped Robin. "There'll be time for that later. She's doing important work here. I could not let her go. She's as good as a trained doctor."
"The young men come out from Bulawayo, one after the other, and she sends them all away,"
Juba went on, ignoring Robin's injunction. "She's a sensible, serious girl," Robin agreed.
"She is a sad girl with a secret."
"Oh, Juba, not every woman wants to spend her life as some man's chattel," Robin scoffed.
"Do you remember when she was a girl?"
Juba went on unperturbed.
"How bright she was! How she shone with joy! How she sparkled like a drop of morning dew!
She has grown up."
"I thought it was the tall young rock finder, the man from across the sea who took Vicky away."
Juba shook her head.
"It was not him. She laughed at Vicky's wedding, and it was not the laughter of a girl who has lost her love. It is something else,"
Juba decided portentously.
"Or somebody else."
Robin was about to protest further, but she was interrupted by the sound of excited voices in the darkness outside the door, and she stood up quickly.
"What is it?"
she called.
"What's happening out there, Elizabeth?"
And the flame of the lantern came bobbing back across the yard, lighting Elizabeth's flying feet, but leaving her face in darkness.
"Mama! Mama, come quickly!"
Her voice rang with excitement. Elizabeth burst in through the door.
"Control yourself, girl."
Robin shook her shoulder, and Elizabeth took a deep breath.
"Old Moses has come up from the village. He says that there are soldiers, hundreds of soldiers, riding past the church."
"Juba, get Bobby's coat."
Robin took her woolen shawl and her cane down from behind the door.
"Elizabeth, give me the lantern."
Robin led the family down the driveway under the dark spathodia trees, past the godowns of the hospital, towards the church. They went in a small, tight group, with Bobby bundled up in a woolen coat, riding on Juba's fat hip. But before they reached the church, there were many other dark figures hurrying along in the darkness around them.
"They are coming out of the hospital,"
Juba was righteously indignant.
"And tomorrow they will all be sick again."
"You'll never stop them," Elizabeth sighed with resignation. "Curiosity killed the cat."
And then she exclaimed,
"There they are! Moses was right. Just look at them."
The starlight was bright enough to reveal the torrent of dark horsemen pouring down the road from the neck of hills. They rode two abreast and a length between each rank. It was too dark to see their faces under the broad brims of their slouch hats, but a rifle barrel stuck up like an accuser's finger behind each man's shoulder, silhouetted against the frosty fields of stars that filled the heavens. The deep dust of the track muffled the hooves to a soft, flowery puffing sound, but the saddles squeaked with the rub of dubbined leather, and a curb chain tinkled
as a horse snorted softly and tossed its head. Yet the quiet was uncanny for such a multitude. No voice raised above a whisper, no orders to close up, not even the usual low warning,
"Where ho!"
of massed horsemen moving in formation across unfamiliar terrain in darkness. The head of the column reached the fork in the road below the church, but took the left-hand turning, the old wagon road towards the south.
"Who are they?"
Juba asked, with a thrill of superstitious awe in her voice.
"They look like ghosts."
"Those aren't ghosts," Robin said flatly. "Those are Jamison's tin soldiers. That's his new Rhodesian horse regiment."